Floridians pass a new minimum wage. What's next? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Of the six constitutional amendments on this year's ballot, four passed. They include the question of citizenship when voting, helping veteran homeowners, and raising the minimum wage. We'll look at what passed and how we move forward as a state. And speaking of the election, as many states continue counting, Florida finished on time. But there are changes underway for both parties. The Sunshine State may be turning more red. We'll hear from the state's political expert, Susan McManus. Finally, a story about unity in the state of political divisiveness with poet Richard Blanco. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, yeah, we're still waiting for those results to come in so we know who finally won the White House. But we don't have to wait in Florida. Florida actually got it right. So let's come back to Florida for a moment and take a look at some of the things that you, the voters, picked for in this election, specifically the constitutional amendments. Let's look at the ones that passed, the ones that didn't. From raising the state's minimum wage to changing the election process, the six amendments on this year's ballot have implications on our wallets and the democratic process. Lawrence Maurer is a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald at the Tallahassee Bureau, and he joins us now via Zoom. Lawrence, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
All right, let's take a look at these amendments. Let's start with probably the big one, really, the one that got a lot of attention, was Amendment 2. This is about raising Florida's minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2026. First of all, remind us how that's supposed to work.
Yeah, this doesn't take effect until, or start to take effect until September 30th of next year, when our minimum wage goes from $8.56 an hour to $10 an hour. Then for every year until 2026, it's going to go up by $1 a year. Then when it hits 2026, Florida's minimum wage will be $15 an hour. And then after that, it'll just increase at the rate it kind of does now, which is with inflation.
All right. What are the arguments for it?
Well, the arguments for it are that, you know, this is going to bring a lot of people, a lot of Floridians out of poverty. You know, $15 an hour is like $30,000 a year. That's a big difference from the current minimum wage. And of course, with greater spending power these people have, they will have more money to spend, obviously, at other businesses. And as people say, a rising tide kind of lifts all boats. There's other benefits to it. Florida's obviously economy is extremely dependent on low wage service jobs. We have our average income is about 87% of the national average, and that's been going down over the last few years.
Yeah. All right. So what about the argument against it?
Well, the argument against it came from primarily from big business groups who argued that this will put too much of a burden on businesses. They'll have to either lay people off or raise prices. And that the pandemic is already hitting companies really hard, and this will be just one more thing, one more stress on businesses.
No. Now, again, as you said, it doesn't take effect until September of next year. And again, it's incremental. It's building up to 2026 to get to that $15 an hour. But we don't know how long this pandemic is going to last. So is there any clause in there that says, well, there's a pandemic, so maybe we could hold off?
Nope, there's nothing like that in there. The language is pretty simple. It says what it says, which is, you know, just one sentence saying that this is going to increase at this rate for this amount of time, basically.
So Orlando attorney John Morgan spent millions trying to get this amendment passed, and he said that he will sue if Florida lawmakers try to undermine the implementation of this amendment. Do you think lawmakers might or could they undermine this amendment?
Well, there's certainly a lot of fear and or speculation about this. Of course, Republican lawmakers have a history of taking constitutional amendments and changing them to fit their kind of desired needs. You know, as Democrats have virtually no power at all in Tallahassee, you know, they've kind of liberal groups have gone to the constitutional amendment process to get things done. And, you know, you look at the felon voting rights amendment, that was severely restricted by the legislature. You look at medical marijuana, which was another amendment that John Morgan, you know, personally spent millions on. And some of these other amendments that have been passed over the years, they have been undermined by the legislature. So there's certainly a fear here. Now, the question, of course, is what would they actually do? And it's not really clear how they could undermine this. There isn't really any wiggle room with the language that Floridians adopted earlier this week when they passed this amendment. So it's not clear. And so far, lawmakers are not saying that they're going to do anything with this. So it's just speculation at this point. But certainly, the big business groups that are heavy, heavy givers to not just Republicans, but Democrats as well, are adamantly against this. And if there's some pressure on lawmakers to do something, they may try.
All right, so again, this passed with 60% of the votes. You have to have 60% to pass an amendment. And if you look at the demographics of the state, that means this is bipartisan. It had bipartisan support. But state Democrats were not that eager in endorsing this, right?
Yeah, the Florida Democratic Party just kind of quietly said that they supported it. They did not make a big deal out of this. The state's top elected Democrat is Nikki Fried. She's the agriculture commissioner. She didn't make any kind of big fuss about this. She didn't even take a position on it until the week before the election. And you know, this is a really, you know, bread and butter issue for Democrats, raising the minimum wage. This is not a radical idea. We're now the eighth state in the country that will adopt a $15 minimum wage sometime in the near future. And you know, if you look at how this played out, over 60% of Floridians, of course, Republicans and Democrats, supported this thing. And it's kind of strange how the Democratic Party just was relatively silent on this issue. You would think that they would be out there on this, and it certainly shows that they might not have quite the pulse on the public that they maybe need.
I'm talking with Lawrence Maurer, reporter with the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald at the Tallahassee Bureau. We're talking about the six constitutional amendments that Floridians voted on in this election, which ones passed and which ones did not. Of course, what these imply for our lives moving forward. Okay, so that one passed. Amendment one passed by a lot. This one is the citizenship requirement to vote passed. This is about changing really two words.
Yeah, this one is kind of unusual, and a lot of people were scratching their heads about this one, but it passed overwhelmingly. Basically, what it did was it changed the wording in the Constitution to say that, quote, only a citizen of the United States can vote, whereas currently it says that every citizen can vote. Now, it might seem like a menial change, something that doesn't make any kind of difference, but to the group that was organizing this, they said that this was kind of a reaction to what they've seen, like in San Francisco, which started allowing non-citizens to vote in local elections. And so, what their argument was is that, you know, by the current wording of the Constitution, saying that every citizen can vote, that is a phrase that could include other people, of course,
But is there any
because it
proof?
just says every citizen. But and so, the wording that's not, now it says only a citizen can vote.
Is there any proof that there have been non-citizens in Florida voting?
No,
Okay.
none that have been produced, and you know, I don't think that this will make much of a difference. There hasn't been a movement that I'm aware of in Florida to allow non-citizens to be voting in Florida elections.
And again, it passed overwhelmingly. All right, let's move on to Amendment 3. This was to open up the state's primary elections to all registered voters. This did not pass, didn't get any support from either party. This one, again, you know, is about the fact that we have a lot of people in Florida who have no party affiliation, which means they cannot take part in the primaries. What happened with this one?
Yeah, this was one that, strangely enough, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party were very much aligned against this. It fell, it needed 60% to pass, just like all the amendments do. It got about 57% of the vote, so it fell short. But clearly it had some support from Republicans and Democrats. This is, yeah, as you mentioned, about a quarter of the state's voters are no party affiliation. Well, that's their registration status. And so they can't participate in primaries. And we've seen other states open up their primaries to non-party affiliated people. And what, you know, the purpose behind this thing was, as the primary backer was saying, that, you know, our parties, because we close off these primaries just to Republicans and just to Democrats, that both sides become more extreme. They cater to the base in the primaries. And so, of course, when you get to the general, we end up with extremists.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, but there was a lot of, obviously, both parties were adamantly against this.
When you look at the makeup of the registered voters, almost a quarter of voters, again, no party affiliation. When you look at that and consider how this election turned out in Florida, a lot more red than expected, could it have helped the Democrats?
You mean if this thing had passed, would it help the Democrats?
If we had a system in place like that already, would it have helped the Democrats?
Well, possibly. It's kind of hard to say. You know, I think certainly some of the winners of our primary elections would be different. If we had open primaries in this state, you know, that there's an argument about how this amendment would have been structured. A lot of people were against it because you could end up with the possibility of two Democrats or two Republicans and running against each other in the general election.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the reasons why people who like the idea of opening up primaries to nonpartisan voters, they were against the way this thing would have structured it. You know, and so they call this kind of idea a jungle primary. And, you know, there were minority groups were worried that, you know, that this could lock out, you know, people of color from running. You know, say if you have a district where you have a significant minority population, yet you have a significant white population that votes for the white candidate, you know, all of a sudden you're left with, you know, you don't have as vigorous a race,
right,
among people of color as you might expect. And so I would see this coming back at some point in some other form in the future.
Yeah. Let's move forward. Let's take a look at Amendment 4. This was intended to make it harder to pass constitutional amendments. It did not pass. Who was for this? Who wanted this?
That's a good question. We don't really know who was funding this thing. It looks like it's business groups, might be utilities. But behind the scenes, Republicans in particular have been wanting to make it much harder to pass constitutional amendments. As I mentioned earlier, you know, Democrats and liberal groups have zero power up in Tallahassee, pretty much. And the constitutional amendment process is where they've kind of gone in recent years to enact policy in the state, like with medical marijuana, with fair districting, with school sizes, with felon voting rights. And so Republicans have kind of trying to take aim at this for a number of years. And what this would have required is, right now you need to pass a constitutional amendment. It needs to pass during one general election. This would have made it so that you had to pass it in two general elections.
Right.
Which is much more difficult.
Right. All right. Let's take a look. Amendments 5 and 6 passed. Just briefly remind us of what they are.
Yeah, these are really special case amendments that deal with tax assessments and stuff. Amendment 5 dealt with the Save Our Homes tax benefit, and basically it allowed people to apply their Save Our Homes tax credit differently in very, very particular circumstances. It's pretty nominal, the effect. Amendment 6 basically applied to spouses of veterans who were honorably discharged over the age of 65 and were permanently disabled by combat. And it allows their spouses to get a discount on their property taxes after that veteran passes away. And this easily passed with like 90% approval. It's again, it applies only to very, very, very specific circumstances.
Some of them seem very simple and probably with little complication. Some of these amendments, I think, like especially the minimum wage, will be very interesting to see as we move forward how that's going to work, because you get the sense there will be pushback. Again, talking with Lawrence Maurer, reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald at the Tallahassee Bureau, helping us understand the amendments that did pass in this election. Lawrence, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Lewis. Anytime.
All right. Well, still to come, what does the 2020 election tell us about the way Florida is heading for future elections? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the vote counting continues in states like Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada. We're still waiting. However, Florida, aside for just a few recounts and tight statewide and local races, well, we wrapped up our count on time. Whew. It was a strong showing for Republicans across the Sunshine State, including in normally blue regions like Miami-Dade. Democrats did pick up some key victories, but the makeup of the House in Tallahassee will be fundamentally different in 2021. Joining us now is University of South Florida Political Science Professor Emeritus Susan McManus. Susan, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. Are you all awake?
No, awake isn't the problem. I am awake, but now what's happened is I am stuck watching these charts, and I'm just looking at the numbers and just waiting to see when is the next state going to finish their count. And that's kind of what I'm doing.
Well, it's certainly occupying everyone at the moment, and it really is hard to keep up. But for a lot of people, they just want it to be over with one way or the other. But it is important to see the whole process work through, and I think that's important.
I do think that one of the fascinating aspects of it is the fact that, well, one, Florida, it actually went pretty smoothly, which is a good thing. So nobody can make jokes about us. But it's also the fact that every state has different rules on when they can start counting. And this is why we're waiting. It also shows how close this race really is. But let's take a look at what happened here in Florida. Democrats had some big losses. A lot of things changed. When you look at, let's start at Miami-Dade. Based on the state polling data and the outreach done by the Trump campaign in the months leading up to this campaign, did what Miami-Dade do, did it surprise you?
Not really in terms of the Latino vote, because there had been signs already that there was some trouble down there in terms of the Biden campaign's approach to winning over that vote. But you have to also keep in mind that when you pick an issue that's so mobilizing for a fairly broad base of people, you can put together a tight coalition that can affect the outcome. And clearly, the Republicans put together the anti-socialism coalition, which extended beyond Cuban Americans and included Venezuelans, Colombians, Nicaraguans, Hondurans, and so forth. And that was very powerful because it is traditional that Cuban Americans turn out to vote at a higher rate. But it was more than that. And the whole coalition was very high turnout. I think that was significant. And when you step back and you wonder, well, how did the Republicans figure this out? Think of it. The lieutenant governor of the state of Florida, Jeanette Nunez, is from there. Marco Rubio is from there. The governor had just won the governorship and knew the state pretty well. Sometimes it's that kind of knowledge that really helps you formulate a good strategy. And that's why, for example, people always want a governor of their party when someone's running for president, because they sort of know the lay of the land. But it was a very mobilizing issue. But the interesting thing is, the problem extended beyond just Miami-Dade to this Hispanic outreach and vote. It extended to other counties that have sizable Hispanic populations as well.
I mean, when you look at Florida in general, so there's just this very, as you mentioned it the last time you were here, a very diverse group of voters to pick from. Let's stick with the Republican Party here. fascinating headline in Politico Florida Playbook today saying, quote, old white men are dying, so the Trump campaign looked elsewhere for voters. How did the campaign evolve this year to reach some new demographic to make up for that?
Well, let's start with women. You saw a lot more women being selected to run for Congress, Republican women running for Congress and also for the state legislature. So that's one group that they were extending beyond. And a lot of those were younger women. And I think that there was a real attention to the younger demographics and the younger people that are part now of the Republican base. But it was also true that they expanded their base into the minority vote. Now, exit polls, of course, can be still contested or people not believe in them. That's all we've got to go on right now. But it looks like 13% of Black men who voted in Florida voted for Trump. And that was something that we've been seeing all over the country. And you saw it in the celebrities that would endorse Trump, sports stars, et cetera. So from, you know, the minority perspective, racial and ethnic perspective, and also from the gender perspective, you saw an attempt and somewhat successful at expanding the base.
Let's do this. Let's do it this way. Let's do an autopsy of both campaigns. Start with the Democrats. When you look at how they handled Florida, you know, what would you find, you know, and what would you tell them?
Number one, and it's a perennial problem, and a lot of people have been talking about it, is over-reliance upon outside the state consultants who do not understand or have time to really recognize the nuances of our very, very diverse populations. That's been a problem in the last couple of elections. And of course, you have now even candidates complaining about pollsters that have been hired by the party, giving them very unrealistic looks at what was on the ground. That's another area. And I think a third thing was the decision to not go door to door when the pandemic hit because of the inconsistency it would create with the Biden campaign about, you know, controlling social distancing and respecting space and so forth.
Yeah.
Those three things really stand out, but the polling blindsided some of the down ballot Democrats who thought they were in pretty good stead, but they weren't. But one more thing, an early warning sign of the problem was when the Republicans were catching up to the Democrats in terms of registered voters. It was a reflection of the energy and the on-the-ground game that the Republicans were already refining before we got to the general election stage.
Yeah, so I mean, so the doing the autopsy on the Republicans, part of it, I guess, would be that they had that energy. They were, you know, getting more registered voters out there. What else did they do right?
Their messaging. I think they were better at targeting messages to different groups. And it's kind of ironic. The Democrats had by far the most money and spent by far the most on television ads. But Republicans relied less on that than they did on you know, more of the spending money on grassroots, people going door to door, checking the pulse of people, recording what issues people were talking about, which then enabled them to design better ways of communication with their message. They had a better micro-targeting strategy. For the most part, the Republican ads, which were just, we had the most ads of any state in the country, TV ads, they were all sort of boilerplate. And the assumption was that the pandemic was the main issue. And as it turned out in the exit polls, there were some other issues that were almost as important, the economy and some other things. So the micro-targeting of message, I think, is very important to understand. These days and age, you can't use the same mechanisms to communicate with someone, nor the same message.
Yeah. Now, you talked about some of those other races down ballot. The two congressional races in Miami-Dade that got a lot of attention, 26th and 27th districts, both flipped Republicans. Maria Elvira Salazar defeated Donna Shalala. Carlos Jimenez defeated incumbent Debbie Mercosal Powell. We had Salazar on the program yesterday, and this is what she attributed to her success.
The only strategy was to get to know the community. You know, I was born and raised in Miami. I know them well. And I just reached out to all of them, specifically during the pandemic. So I went out and I gave thousands and thousands of hot meals. And I think people remember that. And on top of that, this change of words from Donna Shalala talking about socialism and saying that she was a pragmatic socialist and then she was a not a pragmatic socialist. You know, the thing with a socialism, you cannot play around with that word, period. Because for us, that's the inferno.
Do you see, a change in the Republican Party moving forward in the future, or is this just a manifestation of the Trump effect?
Well, it's going to be very interesting because one thing is very, very clear. We are going to see an increasing participation and increasing political clout of Latinos in Florida. That's very, very evident. In fact, by 2040, Florida will be a minority state, and the fastest growing part of that projection is the Hispanic population. No question. And you can see it even in the candidate selection. It used to be that, yes, the Republicans had the Cubans and Democrats had everyone else, but that has changed dramatically. And even the Puerto Rican vote was somewhat split. And the assumption by many was that that was a solidly Democratic voting block.
Yeah.
So I think the power of Latinos in Florida politics can only increase. And both parties will have to adjust to it to be successful.
And as you said, understand it's not one voting block. These are different groups of people from different countries. Understand how one word can mean something very different to each one. Again, I'm talking with Susan McManus, University of South Florida political science professor emeritus, talking about the 2020 general election results here in Florida and how things may be shifting, because President Trump won by a lot more than he did in 2016 over Hillary Clinton. Again, you can find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. A lot of the focus on that 2016 election was on disinformation campaigns on social media, especially to foreign actors. To what extent did that play in this election?
Not nearly as much. The cybersecurity, the threats of outside the country intervention, you know, heading into the election, a lot of people really feared it, but by the end of the, right before the election day and the weeks, a couple weeks out, it was all about misinformation being transmitted into just regular social media, telling people the wrong days to vote and all that kind of thing. We really don't know who did it, but it doesn't look like it was hacking of the nature that we had anticipated intervention from foreign elements before that. So I think that was a good surprise. I think our election officials deserve a big round of applause. We're teaching the whole country about how to do vote by mail and count them and run an efficient election system.
Did I just hear you say Florida can teach the country on an election?
I absolutely said it. In fact, we are no longer Florida, folks. And I put out a tweet yesterday. Don't even call us that anymore. In fact, there's a lot of national commentators that are talking about how well Florida went.
Yeah.
Thank goodness we've got that off our shoulders.
No, and I say that, you know, as a longtime Floridian, have spent most of my life in the state. You know, I'm happy to say, especially to all of my friends in other states, like, hey, we got it right. You know, so don't look at us. Let's talk about polling data, because that's another frustration. Do you think the polling data was more accurate, or was it way off compared to 2016?
It was way off. And here's the downside. Two things. First of all, bad polling data can create the wrong impressions and change how people vote. The voter themselves is affected by that. But secondly, so are the candidates. We saw that. You rely upon them to give you some ideas of how you're doing, how you need to change your tactics or message or whatever. So I think it was really a travesty. Now, the other downside, which people don't realize, is let's say that you have week after week after week, one party ahead, and all the statistics show that that candidate from that party is going to win. Ironically, we know from research that the very people that keeps from coming to vote for that person are supporters because they get complacent. Time goes by, it's short, and they say, oh, well, I don't need to make the effort. I've got something else to do. I don't have to go vote. Believing all the while that their vote wasn't needed for that candidate. And so that it was a real downside of this, too.
So you think
gave a complacency that was not helpful to Democratic candidates.
So you think that because for a long time we kept hearing Biden's got this 8, 9, 10-point lead, oh, then voters were probably like, then you don't need me?
Absolutely. Yes, it was a problem. And I know, and I feel sorry for the voters who are misinformed and for the candidates who are misinformed. Polling needs to be revamped because they are not doing the job. And part of the reason is because they don't do enough detailed demographic work to see that things are changing in one place and another in terms of who lives there and what their beliefs are and what their priorities are.
Yeah.
A small sample size of 400, I'm here to tell you, cannot pick up the nuances in the racial and ethnic and generational diversity that we have in Florida. It cannot. And yet one poll after another, I would see with 400 sample sizes and I just shake my head. Really bad. And honestly, there ought to be a truth in polling list where we keep a record of firms that year in and year out are wrong in Florida. And there are a couple, I'm not mentioning them here, but okay. They're well known to people in the political sphere. And they ought not to get any business nor any attention in the news media.
All right. It looks like I need to do a segment on polling and figure out what that is. All right, so when we look at some of the national exit polls from the New York Times, it was striking to see the issues that were motivating people. 20% of voters said racial inequality. 17% said the pandemic. 35% said the economy. What do you think, though, you know, racial inequality played in Florida? Which one do you think was bigger in Florida?
I think the ones that were bigger here were COVID and the economy. But let's be clear. If you break it down by age, there's a very different story. And this is one of the fascinating things that I saw from the Florida exit poll was the youngest generation, which was Generation Z, went for Biden. And, you know, they are much more likely, they're multiracial in the composition anyway, that generation, and much more likely to cite racial justice of the issued choices that were given on the exit poll. But just look, one generation above them, the millennials, particularly the older millennials, and we see that they tended more to vote for Trump because their big issue was the economy. And it was told to me by one of my millennial former students that the reason for that was that that's the age group that lost a lot of the jobs, restaurants, bars, etc. And when it started opening up, the last thing they wanted was to close down the economy again. This is the kind of nuance that we're talking about, that you have to really slice this population so narrowly. And you see that even on age, the two younger generations were different on which racial versus economy issues were pushing them to vote for what candidate.
Yeah. And talking about, I want to talk about state briefly is, you know, what did we see, if anything, change in Tallahassee? Republicans still in control.
Yes, but you also see a number of new faces that are going to be there among the Republicans, some new candidates, a lot of women actually were elected. And you also saw a couple minorities elected. I think there's now Representative Daniels was one. So I think you'll have a little bit of diversity there. And I see that when the legislature gets back in session, Chris Rawls, who's going to be the Speaker of the House, is young compared to former speakers. And he brought a lot of new ideas into the campaigning for the Republican campaign across the state this time out. So I think that you'll see generational changes in even among the Republicans. But the conservative ideology, of course, is still what drives fiscal conservatism, certainly more than social conservatism among younger Republicans.
Yeah. When you look at the state of Florida, you know, it's always been called the purple state because it's always so close. But really this time, Donald Trump took it by a lot more than he did in 2016. Is it becoming more red?
That's the headlines in some places that we're not a swing state anymore, that we're now a red state. I disagree with that. This is a one-time election where you've got a 3% margin of victory when we're used to five elections prior being 1%. A lot of that is simply because the Democratic outreach and campaigning wasn't as effective as it has been in, I think, previous elections. And that could change. The younger demographic isn't necessarily wed to parties per se. In fact, a high percentage of them register as no party affiliation, but they certainly are prepared to swing in either direction. It's just that this wasn't the election that happened in.
Yeah. So, I mean, how much of this is Trump? Is he just an anomaly?
That's a big question that a lot of us are wondering. Was the vote for him more personality driven? It appears so. If so, does that mean that when he's out of office that things will change and that the party, some of the Republicans that are more moderate will temper some of the more conservative voices? I don't know. Are we in for a long siege of personality candidates winning on both sides of the aisle, or
And
are we going to go back to more of the issue position differences,
yeah.
issue focuses? The younger people suggest that it's going to be, I think, it has to be an individual that's inspirational and directly addresses their issues.
And you had, I mean, Trump was is not a politician. He was a television entertainer.
Right.
And you see, like, for example, Maria Elvira Salazar, former TV anchor. Are we going to see just more of the politician taking in, jumping in, and taking seats?
I don't know, but I think some people are ready for that because traditional politics is disconnecting with a lot of people, the traditional politicians. Even here, notice you had a few incumbent upsets. That would have never happened in the past. That's a discontent with people that against the same old, same old. We're a society now that's very visual. We like things to move along. Any kind of inaction is disturbing. And I think that an underlying current for some of what you saw on the vote for change, where you saw it, was based on what people's frustration with what's going on in Congress, that they can't agree on anything and nothing gets done. So a lot of fascinating moving parts. One other thing that we noticed that was kind of interesting was that the gender gap here in Florida wasn't nearly as wide as it was in a lot of other places, following a pattern that we also saw in 2016. I think in 2016, there were 4% difference among women. I think Trump got 46 and Hillary got 50. Well, this
Yeah.
time it was 52-47. So the gender gap that you saw other places, we didn't see too much of here.
Wow. Interesting, as you said, it's we're a very visual social media world, and let's not forget, it was just a couple years ago, poll showed that people actually wanted Oprah and The Rock to run for office. So that's the world we're living in, I guess. Again, talking with the University of South Florida political science professor emeritus, Susan McManus. Susan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear from community activists across the country who are staying engaged during and after the election season. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, much of this election season, we've experienced the heightened political polarization of this country. The public radio program America Amplified has been exploring those dynamics to try and find real connections. Over the past 5 weeks, the show has featured conversations led by different public radio hosts across the country. We heard from community activists, political scientists, and so many voters across the spectrum. Well, last Saturday, I hosted the show with WABE's Rose Scott in Atlanta. You're going to hear an excerpt from the final portion of the show, speaking with advocates about how they're staying engaged and dealing with the anxiety that's been caused by this election. Now, you could hear last week's episode in its entirety by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. From Seattle, Washington, Larcy Douglas.
And from Pennsylvania, a state that always garners a lot of attention on election night, we welcome Tim Ramos.
And from here in Miami, we have Houston Cypress. All of you, thank you so much for the time today. Houston, I want to start with you. You're a member of the Miccosukee tribe, one of the two tribes here in South Florida. You have focused a lot of your life on community engagement, especially around like the Everglades environmental issues, LGBTQ rights. I'm wondering for you going into this election, what's top of mind?
Top of mind for me going into the election is just trying my best to stay balanced personally so I can continue to be of service to the community. But it's been really difficult. I'm mourning the loss of friends, not only from the pandemic, but the separation of friends from the political polarization that I'm experiencing these days. So just trying my best to stay healthy physically, mentally, spiritually.
Let's head out to Seattle, Washington, and let's bring Larcy Douglas into the conversation. You run a civic-minded organization. It's an action academy for college students. What are you hearing from them?
You know, they have a lot of anxiety. But at the core of it is hope. We often encourage them to, you know, speak what they want to say because they need to get into the habit, into a good practice of really talking about politics. You know, we often joke and say we need to have this to be a habitual part of your life, like going to the dentist. And so really going in and having those conversations to get them to the comfort level of voicing their opinions, building a community for them to talk about all of those fears and hopes and emotions, it's really helpful and probably why they're so driven right now to do something about it.
Tim, going out there, you are in one of those battleground states that is going to be watched very carefully in this election. You're a community advocate, and I'm wondering for you, top of mind, what's most important in the work you've been doing for this upcoming election? And it could be beyond the national politics.
Well, definitely in my area here in where I live in Pennsylvania, where there's just so many different issues facing us. Of course, the issues of the pandemic, as I believe Larcy and Houston talked about, different people with anxiety and the polarizing subjects. I'm always an individual. I'm more solutions-based thinker. I'm a Republican myself, but in dealing with both parties, I think there's been a kind of awakening in the Black and Hispanic community where we're looking at both parties and we're saying, hey, you guys have to earn our votes and earn our support. And that's kind of the message I've been driving home in my city, where I live in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and it's a 3-1 Democrat city. And for the larger part of the last 30 years, the community is not listened to because you have a kind of one party rule system. And I always say that had it been the other way around, I'd be on the other side fighting the same fight, because we need our leaders to begin to listen to our community and listen to the voters. I see so many people stressed by the presidential election, but the message I've been giving to our community is that the pressure begins from the ground up. At least in our area, we're not accepting the status quo from either party. We're putting pressure on them to begin to represent the communities that they say they want to represent and do the job the way we, the voters, want them to do it, not the way they do it according to their agenda or their ideology, but actually representing the interests of their constituents.
You know, it reminds me that I personally can't burn bridges, because working in the environmental sphere, working on behalf of LGBTQ community, and working in the spiritual community as an ordained minister, I still have to be able to help facilitate these processes. I still got to be able to go and visit these communities. I still got to be able to talk and make friends across the aisle, across the language barrier, and rely on facilitation techniques.
Can you give us some insight into those techniques? Because you are at a lot of different intersections.
You know, one of the main things that I'm looking at right now is being able to sit with discomfort And when we're having community discussions, things can kind of go off on a tangent. And that's a situation that we call the groan zone. And so it's really about learning to sit with that discomfort, helping people to do the same, and also gently guiding things back into a situation where we're where we begin to see commonalities, where we begin to see a pathway forward.
This idea of bringing people together to talk about issues, and as different as they may be, we got to sit down and talk about issues. Larcy, I mean, that's kind of what I remember learning in civics class. Is like that's part of this country is the ability to sit down, debate, and then compromise. This, again, is part of what you're doing and when you're working with students, right?
Absolutely. And creating a space for that kind of dialogue to happen is definitely key. We have students coming in saying, you know, they're registering their parents for the first time, and or I got my friend to actually care about voting because the community that we've created allows them to have that practice, right? So, you know, for every dialogue that we start, we just have a set of kind of house rules. You know, we respect one another. We want to hear what you have to say. It's coming from a place of curiosity and openness and not a place of judgment. And basic kind of dialogue rules that we start off with like that kind of sets the tone. You need to walk the talk. So I am waiting to see their creativity, and I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of them kind of sprinkle and pop up in other places where they can take leadership and civic engagement.
Larcy Douglas from Seattle, Washington. Houston Cypress out of Miami. Tim Ramos from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Thank you all.
Appreciate y'all.
Thank you very much. Take care.
There is a lot of tension and uncertainty in the air, and we get it. Our nation is divided, and you can see that anywhere you look. But at the same time, there's a lot connecting us. And each week, we've been hearing that from you. We've been learning what it is to be part of this country, for better or worse.
Richard Blanco has thought a lot about this. He's a renowned poet, the son of Cuban exiles, raised here in Miami, where I live. Growing up, he says, it was those American ballads we all know that fueled his early, and as he says, innocent ideas of what it is to be part of this nation, an idea that's evolved over time.
America the beautiful, again. How I sang, oh beautiful, like a psalm at church with my mother, her Cuban accent scaling up every vowel, oh beautiful, yet in perfect pitch, delicate and tuned to the radiant beams of stained glass light. How she taught me to fix my eyes on the crucifix as we sang our thanks to our Savior for this country that saved us. Our voices hymns as passionate as the organ piping towards the very heavens. How I sang, for spacious skies, closer to those skies, while perched on my father's sunbeat shoulders, towering above our first 4th of July parade. How the timber through our bodies mingled, breathing, singing, as one with the brass notes of the marching band, playing the only song he ever learned in English. How I dared sing it at assembly with my teenage voice cracking, for amber waves of grain that I'd never seen, nor the purple mountain majesties, but could imagine them in each verse rising from my gut. Every exclamation of praise I belted out until my throat hurt, America, and again, America. How I began to read Nietzsche and doubt God, but still wished for God to shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood. How I still want to sing, despite all the truth of our wars and our gunshots ringing louder than our school bells, our politicians smiling lies at the mic, the deadlock of our divided voices shouting over each other instead of singing together. How I want to sing again, beautiful or not, just to be in harmony from sea to shining sea with the only country I know enough to know how to sing for.
En un país normal, la normal es transformar.
That was poet Richard Blanco reading his poem, America the Beautiful, again. And again, that's an excerpt from the public radio program America Amplified, which aired last Saturday on WLRN. You can listen to the podcast by going to our social media. A new episode of the series will be released this Saturday as well, focusing on the election results and the state of our democracy in 2020. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, November 5th. Coming up next week on the show, we're going to continue to keep you updated on the national election results. You can always stay up to date during Morning Edition or All Things Considered. NPR will have special coverage once either candidate secures enough electoral votes. Plus, we're going to be speaking with the leadership at FIU after a video with racist comments went viral on social media. How is student behavior being monitored on the web? And what are the grounds for kicking a student off campus? Also, in November, we're doing something a little different for the Sundial Book Club. We'll be featuring a number of different authors. We'll be appearing virtually at the Miami Book Fair this year. We want to get you started. We're reading The Extraordinary Life of Jane Wood Reno, Miami's trailblazing journalist. Find that on Facebook on our Sundial Book Club. Also, stay tuned to WLRN. We'll keep you updated on Tropical Storm Ada. It might be going into the Caribbean this weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you live again on Monday.